Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news and highlight in-depth reporting. We begin today's show by discussing a new Frontline documentary called Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world. Amazon is now worth $1 trillion, and it's trading at $2,119 a share. And yet, as you will hear in this trailer, Jeff Bezos is the richest guy in the world, and he's got employees on food stamps.
I'm Jeff Bezos.
What is your claim to fame?
I'm the founder of Amazon.com.
Intensely focused on scaling up.
Most important longer-term thinker alive.
World's most customer-obsessed company ever.
Big things start small.
This February...
Everything that is admirable about Amazon is also something that we should fear about it.
Frontline investigates Amazon.
One shipped more orders than Amazon.
How much market share does Amazon want? They want all of it.
Is Amazon a monopoly?
I would argue that Amazon is so dominant that it warrants antitrust scrutiny.
Amazon was not simply going to be an e-commerce platform, but an invisible infrastructure that powers our everyday lives.
We started working on this device,
Alexa.
This data collection is extremely important to this business model. Convincing people to just deploy something like this in their home, it's a brilliant trick to achieve that.
From the award-winning team of The Facebook Dilemma.
What Jeff Bezos is after is really creating a company that is the infrastructure, that owns the infrastructure for how commerce is done.
Frontline examines the richest man in the world.
Richest guy in the world, and he's got employees on food stamps.
We're not treated as human beings. We're not even treated as robots. We're treated as part of the data stream.
You just go and go and go, and if you're not keeping up with your rate, they correct it rapidly. These workers are being watched on a level that I don't think people understand.
Do any of the concerns about power resonate with you?
We believe strongly that we're good for the economy, we're good for the American workforce, and we're obviously good for consumers.
The internet is disrupting every media industry. People can complain, but complaining is not a strategy.
In what world are there no critics? In an autocratic, totalitarian world, maybe they're not allowed. Bezos clearly thinks he answers to no one.
He bought the Washington Post to have political influence.
Transforming itself from seller to creator.
It helps us sell more shoes.
We're increasingly living in a world in which your designs are there. Can you see how it could be concerning in some ways that we all can't opt out of that world at this point?
The reality of it is that world happened way before Ring or Alexa.
Some people are asking if Amazon is a monopoly.
The question for the democracy is, are we okay with one company essentially winning capitalism?
A two-hour special presentation.
There's a lot of people questioning the size and power of Amazon. How do you and Jeff think about the call to break you guys up?
Simply because the company's been successful doesn't mean it's somehow too big.
Amazon Empire.
Is Amazon taking over the world a good thing?
Domination was very much the idea.
That is the trailer for Frontline's new documentary, Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos. For the past year, Frontline producers have been investigating how he turned Amazon from a tiny company selling books into a business empire that is without precedent in the history of American capitalism. The film also raises many important questions about the cost of Amazon's convenience. The team was led by James Jacoby and today's guest, Anya Borg, an award-winning producer for Frontline and co-producer of the new documentary. You can watch it now. It's streaming online, pbs.org/frontline. You can find it on YouTube and the PBS video app. Hi, Anya. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for making this really important film.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I think what was so effective in the film is that you spoke with a number of former Amazon employees and current Amazon employees. How were you able to get so many of these employees to go on the record?
Well, we were really fortunate that Amazon agreed to participate and give us interviews with current executives and really some of the top executives under Jeff Bezos And I think their participation helped kind of get their perspective across and also made the film much richer and much deeper. As far as talking with former employees, that was actually much more difficult than any experience I'd had in the past. I think a lot of former Amazonians, as they call themselves, were reluctant to talk about the company. So the ones that did, we really appreciated their perspective.
And we'll talk about this later in the show, but a number of small business owners were hesitant to talk because Amazon has so much power over their business and their bottom line.
Well, both small and big businesses. We spoke with large companies and large brands, all of whom do business with Amazon. And what we found is that a lot of the more well-known brands and well-known companies were really reluctant to talk about Amazon because they do so much of their business through the company. And they didn't want to do anything to alienate or irritate, you know, what is one of their number one buying partners. And that spoke kind of volumes to us about the power of the company and what they represent. But we did speak with some smaller sellers, some of whom were, and I spoke on background and off the record with a lot of sellers and big companies. So I think we had a real understanding of what the experience and the challenges can be for sellers and companies on Amazon. There's a lot of benefits to being on Amazon. People reach, you know, millions of customers, but there are also a lot of challenges these days.
This company is just so incredibly massive. You know, everything from selling millions of products to now making movies. You're now hearing at the Oscars and the Golden Globes, Jeff Bezos and Amazon are being thanked on a regular basis. You've got the cloud computing and these contracts with the Pentagon, facial recognition software, and the company working with police departments. I'd forgot that Amazon bought Ring, that camera that people put in their homes, and now Ring's being hacked in some cases. So this is just a massive company. When you all sat down and decided to take on this project, what were your main goals?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, when we first sat down to consider whether or not to do this film, it just, because of what you just described, it felt overwhelming as a film. And I think, you know, I felt, my initial thought was, this isn't a good idea. You know, how do you make a film about a company that's this sprawling and where the problems are so many and so diverse? How could you ever kind of tell a coherent story? So at the beginning, it seems, and throughout the process, many times it felt like a really big challenge just trying to do kind of, we used to call it the everything story. Because I mean, Brad Stone, who wrote a book about Amazon called The Everything Store, which was in many a very helpful resource for us along the way, and that's really how it felt. But I think, you know, it wound up that the power of the film in some ways is because of the scope of it. When you really understand how deeply entrenched Amazon has become in all of our lives, in our economy, in our government, then you really realize the power and scale of the company.
You also spoke to a number of really good investigative reporters who have uncovered so much about Amazon, whether it's the treatment of workers and at one factory, the heating system was just not working well, and so people were actually going to the hospital. That got so much media attention. People are, you know, now talking about Amazon's power in Washington, D.C., thanks to investigative reporters. So can you talk about just the power of journalism and covering a company like this?
Absolutely. I mean, we really benefited from all of that work, and one of the nice things about being at Frontline is that, you know, we're in a position where we can kind of interview other reporters and highlight the work that they do in a big story like this. And people like you described, Spencer Soper, who's now a reporter at Bloomberg, is, you know, he had written some of the first stories about working conditions in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He worked for a paper there called The Morning Call. And he wrote a terrific series of articles about Amazon facilities and kind of how difficult the working conditions had been. This is back around 2011. In the summer, the temperatures inside the facilities were over 100 degrees, and employees were, as he said, kind of parading in and out of the emergency room. And there had been complaints both from ER doctors and security guards about what they were seeing. Amazon did respond and install air conditioning systems after that. And so what we found was that the challenges in the working conditions within the warehouses have changed and morphed as the company has kind of become more dependent on robotics. But all of that investigative reporting that you're referring to was really very, very helpful to us, and also just sort of helping to, you know, I think get people to understand how a little bit more about Amazon along the way. We also interviewed Trish Callahan, who's a reporter at ProPublica, who had done a series of articles more recently about drivers and private contractors that Amazon uses now for what they call their last mile delivery system. And her work was very helpful as well.
And to add a little bit more about the warehouse in Pennsylvania, you also point out, and this report pointed out, that at that time people were walking in these massive warehouses. They were walking 10 to 15 miles every day, really crisscrossing the warehouse all day. People were heated. People were treated for heat stress. Pregnant women were suffering from heat stress. So at that time, this job was incredibly taxing.
It was. And, you know, we've spoke to, I probably spoke to at least 50 fulfillment center workers across the country in about five states. And our team spoke to even more. And I think the common thread, and these are both former and current fulfillment center workers, the common thing you heard from all of them was how both physically and physically and psychologically exhausting the jobs could be. I think the complaint about walking was something that you hear less of now. There are still some fulfillment centers in various states where I think workers do a lot of traversing of these big warehouse spaces. But one of the things that has cut down on that is that Amazon acquired a company back, I believe, around 2000, and well, I can't remember the year now, maybe 2013, that makes robots. It was called Kiva. And the robots kind of bring the items now to the workers in many ways. So the walking has been reduced, but there are still incredible stresses that employees feel. They have something called time off task. They're kind of constantly being monitored. They feel like they have to keep up with these rates, which aren't realistic. You know, they don't have time to take a breath or chat with their coworkers, or it's just this constant pace. And shifts can be 10 or 12 hours, so you can imagine how draining that is.
You spoke with a number of employees in San Bernardino. They all sat down for an interview on camera, and 15,000 employees work in that warehouse. And like you said, a lot of them said, at first, I thought it was exciting to work with Amazon. I thought I would go up in the company and this would be a lifelong, really good job. But there's no way to make the rate. And if you do make the rate 1 week, the rate goes up the next week. And they also said that there are security cameras right behind you. You cannot talk to people. And one of the key points is that it's hard to meet rate rules if you follow the safety procedures.
Yeah, so we interviewed actually dozens of workers in the San Bernardino area off camera. And then the group that we brought who were willing to go on camera, and it was really hard to get people to be comfortable with that. They all worked in different facilities, but in that San Bernardino area, the Riverside and San Bernardino, where Amazon has a very large hub. And they described really, you know, exactly what you just said, which is that, you know, the pressures to make rate were incredibly intense. And that they felt like they couldn't do it without cutting corners. Amazon does have a lot of safety procedures and rules and regulations in place, but that people said, you know, there's no way to do this job properly and do it as quickly as they're expecting you to do it. It was really grueling. And one of the other things that I heard from people in the area is that there's a mental health clinic down the street from some of these facilities where they see a lot of fulfillment center workers because there's so much anxiety. You know, they have this little clock that counts down 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, and they're watching it all day long. They have, you know, let's say 30 seconds to complete each task or 15 seconds, and then it just sort of would instill so much anxiety if you're imagining doing that for hours on end.
Wow. So today there are 600,000 employees working for the company in the U.S. Most are in warehouses, and almost every state has a warehouse. Is that right?
That's my understanding, yes.
Today we are speaking with Anya Borg, an award-winning producer for Frontline. She and James Jacoby led the team for Frontline. They spent a year on this documentary. It's called Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos. And you can watch it now. It's streaming on pbs.org/frontline. You can also find it on YouTube and the PBS video app. And it really explores so many facets of Jeff Bezos and his fairly new empire. I mean, he started this, what, back in 1995, and now they are in so many aspects of society. You can give us a call if you have any questions for Anya about what they found at your call at kalw.org or 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. We have a former Amazon worker on the line. Let's go to Vahid in Menlo Park. Hi, Vahid. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me on. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I worked for Amazon Web Services from June of 2015 to March of 2018. And there are actually three or four areas that really concerned me about Amazon. One is the level of embeddedness of Amazon in the defense industry, in the CIA, with a $900 million infrastructure contract, and now bidding on the JEDI contract that's valued at about $10 billion for the defense industry. At the same time, that Amazon is selling Alexas and in-home devices that monitor voice. They're working with every single intelligence agency in terms of Amazon Web Services Group in providing them with infrastructure. And that just does not make me feel comfortable from using Alexa devices in my own home. The second thing that I wanted to highlight was Amazon partners. Companies like DXC Technologies, the old CSC, Computer Science Corporation, which was responsible for rendition programs back in 2000 of Khalid al-Masri and a number of other civilians that were taken aboard these planes. Amazon is partnered with these companies that show no respect towards humanity. Finally, Amazon's Darwinism. They believe in, you know, survival of the fittest, and unfortunately, I'm disabled, and there's really no room for disabled people within an organization like Amazon. Hmm. I came back after a medical leave, and I was told that I should go look for a job elsewhere, that my job was taken by new employees that were just brought in, and I was basically chastised aside, and all my accounts, all my responsibilities taken away, and that lasted for 30 days for me. After that, I went for 30 days of psychiatric care at Stanford University and Dignity Health just to rebound from what took place at Amazon and recover from it. And then one thing I just want to ask is, you know, what do you think the solution would be? I personally think that, you know, boycotting an organization this size doesn't work, but breaking up Amazon into smaller pieces, especially their AWS side that controls so much of the infrastructure, so many websites are running on it, would make a lot of sense. And I'm just curious in terms of your guest's view on, you know, how you would deal with an organization this size. And finally, I wrote a book documenting my experience at Amazon. If anybody's interested, it's called Ethics in Tech and Lack Thereof. And you can find it on myawsstory.com that documents what happened to me at AWS.
Wow. Well, Vahid, thank you. I'm so sorry to hear about your experience. And we'd love to actually have you on the show to talk more about this. So thank you for calling. Anya, what about that key question? What can be done about this?
Yeah, well, that is the question that regulators are looking at both here in the U.S. and in the EU. I just want to, before I address that, also say that, you know, the experience that your caller shared was something that I did hear from kind of, you know, white collar employees at within, you know, in Seattle as well, that I think the company culture is a very rough one. The New York Times in 2015 had a piece about that. And I did hear that a lot of people really struggled. I think in some ways the culture at the fulfillment center has trickled down from that. As far as the question of what can be done, I think that's the question for regulators. You know, I'm not really in a position to answer that, but there are a number of things that are on the table. So the subcommittee on antitrust within the Judiciary Committee in Congress is currently has a very robust investigation of Amazon that is going on, and they'll be looking at whether or not there is new legislation that needs to address a company like Amazon, which really represents a kind of unique antitrust challenge, because it's unlike anything that's really existed before. The FTC has its own inquiry and has recently been kind of beefing up and hiring a new, what they call, I think, a tech enforcement division to look at all the platform companies. And regulators in the EU are also struggling to figure out how do you deal with a company like Amazon, where they are embedded in so many parts of the economy, but also where they're sort of controlling a marketplace and competing on it at the same time. That's one of the principal challenges that they're looking at. So there are folks that have been suggesting that the company should be broken up. I'm not sure whether or not that would, you know, really address all of the issues, and whether or not it would, you know, prevent Amazon from being anti-competitive within each of those subgroups after that point. But it certainly would address some of the challenges that we now face.
To Vahid's point about the ruthless business practices, this was a fascinating part of the documentary. We learned that for the first 20 years, Amazon knew that it wouldn't be profitable. And Jeff Bezos sent a letter to shareholders and potential Wall Street investors basically saying, this is about the long term. Our strategy is to lose money, which will enable us to put companies out of business, at that time booksellers that can't afford to lose money. My strategy is to put them out of business in the long run. You have to just come along for the ride.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't quite that explicit. I think what Jeff Bezos was saying was it's all about the long term. And that's what he said in his letter to shareholders. And for the first, you know, maybe 8 or 10 years, the company didn't make a profit. I think they started making a profit somewhere around 2003. And after that, there were very slim profits. But what Jeff Bezos was articulating was, I have a long-term vision for how to build market share and have this company grow. And really back at that time and until recently, there was something, you know, none of that sounded sinister. In some ways, that was what we wish more companies did. We're in an environment right now where all these companies are just buying back their own stocks and they're all, you know, so focused on Wall Street and these short-term returns. So what I think Amazon was articulating was, you know, we want to build something big and important here. But now I think it looks a little, in retrospect, there's a slightly different perspective on what it was the company was asking Wall Street to do. And one of the questions that a lot of people have had is, you know, Wall Street gave Amazon a bit of a unique leash, and, you know, was willing to continue to keep the stock price high and continue investing when the company wasn't taking profits out and returning dividends to shareholders and instead was sort of continuing to reinvest in the company and reinvest in building something.
You did speak with Melville's publisher, Dennis Johnson, saying that at the time it was a small publishing house. Well, they were a small publishing house, although we tend to get a lot of books from Melville. And they are selling on Amazon. And one day he heard from Amazon and they wanted a 4% kickback on book sales. Can you tell us more about this strategy and specifically this Gazelle project?
Sure. So the Gazelle project was something that we heard about from former and as Amazonians and reporters, which was early on in the books division that Jeff Bezos had said in a meeting, we need to go after publishers the way a cheetah would go after a wounded gazelle, and that we should go after the smaller publishers first to negotiate tough terms, and that then word will trickle up. And, you know, in many ways, that's what a lot of retailers have done. You know, that was an old Walmart trick, was what someone had told us. So Amazon wasn't doing something entirely unique, but they were setting very tough terms with publishers big and small. And Dennis Johnson was one of the few publishers that was willing to go on the record, because so many publishers are in a position where they sell 50 to 80% of their books on Amazon. So they don't feel at liberty to really talk publicly about the ways in which the company has been, you know, has been a tough negotiating partner. And Amazon has demanded very tough terms from publishers. You know, there was an episode in 2007 when Amazon unveiled the Kindle. It put them in a really unique position. No one else had a successful ebook reader. And Jeff Bezos went on stage and announced that all books would be $9.99, which was a number that he had kind of come up with out of thin air because it sounded like a good number to him. Publishers who were there for that told us that they were shocked to hear that, you know, that that wasn't really going to be what they thought was sort of a fair return on the investment that they and their authors were making in providing a book. And so that in many ways set off even more tension within the publishing industry between publishing houses and Amazon. What Dennis Johnson was talking about was actually before all of that. Back in around 2004, Amazon came to him and said they wanted more of a cut, as he put it, on their his profits. And he pushed back and said no. And then all of the buy buttons on his books disappeared. And this was something that Amazon would continue to do. They did it with, Macmillan in 2010, and then they did it again to some degree with Hachette in 2014. And so back in 2004, when they did it to Dennis Johnson, he lasted for a few weeks and then realized he couldn't afford to not be selling books on Amazon. So he paid what at the time he said he called a bribe. And went on to have his buy button restored. So these were the kinds of tactics that Amazon employed, and I think when Amazon was a small share of the market, those were just driving, you know, tough tactics on the part of a retailer. It's what has become more of an issue is that now that Amazon is so large and dominates so much of the sales of books around the country and the world, those types of tactics are really the kinds of behaviors that antitrust regulators are looking at to say, now that you have so much dominance, are you behaving in anti-competitive ways?
Right, because as the documentary points out, small businesses, large businesses say they really have no choice but to do business with Amazon, and Amazon has access to all of their data. They increasingly put higher fees on these businesses to stay on the platform, and they pressure them to use Amazon's warehouse and shipping services.
Yeah, we spoke with, you know, sellers on Amazon. So almost 60% of everything that's sold on Amazon is sold through what's called a third-party seller, which means it's not coming directly from Amazon. It's sold by someone, either, a small or large company that wants to use Amazon's platform. And initially, Amazon represented a tremendous opportunity for those sellers because suddenly, you know, imagine you're selling socks. You can suddenly reach millions of customers to buy your socks. And I think what's happened over, you know, the past couple of decades is that sellers have found, particularly in the last 5 years, that the terms that Amazon is setting on their marketplace have gotten harder and harder. So, you know, there are lots of counterfeits on Amazon. You have to pay additional fees in order to have what they call gating services. You have to pay all kinds of marketing fees if you want to show up early in the results and have, you know, advertising fees. Amazon encourages you to use its shipping and handling services to go have your goods go through their fulfillment centers. And, you know, all of those kinds of things help to determine whether or not you get what's called the buy box. So behind each listing, there are, you know, hundreds of people selling the same product. But Amazon is the one who determines whether or not, you know, you get that sale, because by and large, as a customer on Amazon, when you search for something, you buy the first thing that is presented to you. You don't go looking for some other seller sort of behind the first screen. Amazon really controls that.
We're almost out of time, but the other thing that was fascinating in the film is when Amazon launched Prime, which is two-day free shipping for $79 a year, more than 150 million people signed up. And when you think about, I mean, we all see these Amazon vans driving around the city, and these drivers are under intense pressure to deliver the packages. And in the film, we learned that they figured out a way to get around regulations because those small-ish cargo vans, they're big enough to stuff with packages, but they're small enough to not be regulated by the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Trish Callahan is referring to there is that she was looking for how many accidents involving Amazon drivers had occurred within the past few years and how many deaths they caused. And what she found was it was almost impossible to know, because unlike UPS that has employee drivers and marked trucks, Amazon uses outside independent contractors with, they used to be oftentimes be white unmarked vans. And so when there were accidents, it wasn't always indicated that there was an Amazon vehicle. So the fact was that she couldn't track down how many fatalities there had been. And both she and we asked Amazon if they would provide those numbers. They were not willing to do so. Yes, the genius of Prime, which initially was $79, today it costs more, has sparked, 150 million people to sign up to be members. It's been, as Scott Galloway called it, the most successful membership program ever.
In our remaining minute, Anya, can you talk about the power that Jeff Bezos and Amazon now has in D.C.? As you point out, they're spending millions a year on lobbying. Jeff Bezos bought the largest mansion in Washington, designed to basically create a presence where he could hobnob with policymakers. He bought the Washington Post for $250 million. He also hired a former Barack Obama White House spokesperson, Jay Carney, to be a senior VP.
I mean, Amazon is doing what all big smart companies do, which is to have a big lobbying presence. I think what's different is that Amazon sees a business opportunity in the U.S. government, and that is somewhat unique. They have been, their cloud computing division, which is a huge part of Amazon's profit center, has been, more quietly succeeding in winning all of these government contracts. And the biggest one they just kind of famously lost, which was this Defense Department contract called the JEDI contract, and they're now challenging that in court and saying that President Trump actually intervened and blocked them from winning that contract, which they think they deserve to win. So what's different about Amazon is both the size and scale of its presence, and then also the fact that it sees this unique business opportunity there. There's also a $50 billion procurement contract that Amazon has been very aggressively fighting to win, which is just, supplying, being the sole supplier of goods to the U.S. government. They just see that government is a big business, and they are in a position to kind of win all of these contracts.
Well, Anya, we'd love to have you back because we only really scratched the surface on this documentary. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Anya Borg,
I appreciate you having me. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Anya Borg is an award-winning producer for Frontline and co-producer of their new documentary, Amazon Empire, The Rise and Reign of Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos is now the richest man in the world. And you can watch the documentary. It's streaming on pbs.org/frontline, YouTube, and the PBS video app. You can also see a trailer at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a short break, we'll speak with Carlotta Gall, Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. Well, we will talk about the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are now going to turn our attention to the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe in Syria. Joining us is Carlotta Gall, an Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. She was part of the team that received a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of Afghanistan and Pakistan in 2009, and she's author of The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Hi, Carlotta. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Carlotta, I want to first ask you kind of a basic question. There was a piece by your colleague Megan Specia in 2018 about what's going on in Syria, and she wrote, in 7 years, the casualties of Syria's civil war have grown from the first handful of protesters shot by government forces to hundreds of thousands of dead. Now we are over 500,000. And she writes, as the war has dragged on, many international monitoring groups have essentially stopped counting. What does that look like today?
Well, we're actually in the last finale of it, and the most horrendous movement of people, in fact, the biggest movement of people in this 9-year war. So now you've got the last province that is held by the opposition who have been protesting against the government of Bashar al-Assad since the beginning of the 2011 uprising. Now the Russian forces, in fact, they're mostly doing the work, and Syrian forces are trying to take control of that last province. And so what's happened is that everyone is fleeing from those homes, from the onslaught, because it's massive aerial bombardment and artillery bombardment on whole towns as well as villages. So everyone is fleeing north to the Turkish border, and the Turks closed the border years ago because they couldn't take so many refugees. So everyone is being trapped in a smaller and smaller area right by the border, which they hope the border will give them some safety. But as you can imagine, when you get so many people fleeing into a smaller and smaller space, you've got people without shelter, people living in people trying to tents, camping in the open air, in the cities. I mean, it's an absolute disaster. We've had, the aid agencies are telling us, nearly a million people moving in the last 2 months. Moving to the border. Yeah.
In one of your latest pieces, It's Like the End of the World, you report that the lucky ones are crammed into tent camps, others sleep in the open on the surrounding hillsides where it's very, very cold, and at least 12 children have died of exposure.
That's just what we've managed to track and confirm cases. So we think there's probably ones that we don't know about. But there are obviously aid agencies in there, and so they've been able to. So we've talked to doctors across the border who've been able to confirm that those are the cases that of people who've died from exposure. I mean, that includes, you know, a teenager. Very distressing. People are in really desperate straits because there's lack of food, as well as shelter, and lack of heating. So even if they have a tent or a plastic cover over there, some of the people are living in their cars, and if they have a plastic seat to keep them the rain off, they still freeze because they've got no heating. So it's really, really desperate.
You quoted a jewelry trader, Mohammed, who was traveling with his wife, Amina, to get their children from Syria and bring them back to Turkey. He described the mood across the border in one word: threat. He said people are afraid. The situation is very bad. People are living in the streets, under the trees. They're very cold. So can you just give us a sense of what does the border look like? Just talk about what you saw there.
It's a distressing thing, actually, for us journalists. We are not allowed into Turkey. Into Syria, to close the border. So Syrians fleeing cannot cross unless they jump illegally over the wall, and we can't get in there to report. At least they're letting very few reporting crews go in. So I was at the border, which was freezing. And just hard standing there talking to people. But most of the people were desperate to get family and relatives out. One young man got back because he just had his father died. And, he was going to have his family. So every story you meet of some people is desperate. So the traders are among the few who are allowed to cross. Have a business in both countries. So some people can cross, but they can't bring often extended relatives. The doctor was allowed to cross because aid people are allowed to cross, but he said it was a horrendous journey and he had to evacuate his family from his village, very short notice as the bombardment came closer and closer. So it's everyone is extremely distressed. That's what you see when you're trying to talk to people at the border, and almost in tears.
We're speaking with Carlotta Gall, Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times, and sorry, her line is going in and out. We're connecting with her in Turkey, and she has been reporting on the humanitarian crisis in Syria. Carlotta, can you just give us a sense? Now that we've got this presidential race in the U.S.,
it was very hard to hear you. There, the line's breaking up.
Okay.
A sense of
just some context, because now that we have this presidential race in the U.S., that's getting most of the attention. Although NPR did have a piece on Syria this morning with the voices of Syrians, can you give people some context? Why is this going on for so long now in its ninth year, and this humanitarian crisis just continuing?
Well, this is the distressing thing. In fact, Turkey, is where I live, is stuck in the middle. They're trying to create a safe zone to at least help the people who are fleeing have some safety and guard it, as it were, from the Russian and Syrian government onslaught. And Russia is really pushing this. The Syrian government and Russia want to take the whole area. They want their country back, to seize the area from what is the opposition, the people opposed to the central government. And, you know, in the old days, the world would have stood up and said, if you remember, you know, the world created the safe zone when it was Saddam Hussein in Iraq and protected people who dissented from being bombed. Now, this is not happening. The Europe and NATO and the U.S. are not stepping in to say enough. You know, we have to protect people, ordinary people. You know, the UN is saying 71% of the people who are fleeing are women and children. So it's not like that, you know, the danger is from the men and the fighters. The bulk of the people are civilians. But the world is weary. That's what we're being told. There's a funding shortage for the aid organizations trying to provide tents. There's just not enough tents. The world is looking elsewhere. Europe wants more immigrants. It's extraordinary. I've been a war reporter for 25 years. I have never seen so much international indifference to this. It's extraordinary.
Wow. What do you think explains that?
Well, diplomats tell me it's the result of years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq. I think it was the disaster that the Iraqi war was, made everyone feel we can't do more, we can't risk our soldiers more, we can't help, especially in America. But I think it's also our leaders don't want to. They're not interested. They're fighting internal elections. And the UN has...
Carlotta?
Russia can veto everything.
Sorry about that, Carlotta. It seems like we're going in and out a bit. Can you just repeat what you said last?
I think that the UN is increasingly useless. You know, I cut my teeth in Bosnia, where UN came in and intervened and helped. But the UN now, when we read and listen to the debates on Syria in the UN Security Council, the UN officials are just mouthing pleas, but they know that the Security Council is vetoed. Every decision is vetoed by Russia because that's the way it's structured, and nothing will move. So the UN has become more and more redundant in resolving or intervening in humanitarian disasters. So if you don't have the leadership, and I think the leadership in the U.S. is definitely not there to intervene, Europe, we know, has always been slow on these things. So there's just a lack of national will to do anything. And I think also a feeling that how do you stop Russia when Russia's behaving like this? And that's the great dilemma here. Even for Turkey, Turkey cannot stand up alone, Russia. But perhaps also hasn't acted in the cleverest way to get international support for its position.
Carlotta, what are you hearing from Syrians about what response they would want the international community to take?
Well, they are actually, it's really poignant. They are immediately saying, we wish Europe would stand up. We know there are meetings with NATO. We know there are European leaders meeting with President Erdogan of Turkey and so on. And we wish America would draw a red line and intervene, but then they all immediately say, but we know it won't happen. So they've become very inured to accepting that no one is going to help them, and I think that's been the pattern of the Syrian war. A lot of the people who began in the protests and the uprising for democracy and dignity and people's rights in 2011 have just seen that the international support hasn't been there. So they're now very inured to that and despairing. But they still ask you, could it happen? Would it happen? We would like it to happen. So that's what I found on the border. People were saying, we're still hoping America would wake up and listen or help. They're also very, very despairing.
Today we're speaking with Carlotta Gall, Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. She has been a war reporter for 25 years, and she's covering the humanitarian crisis in Syria from Turkey. She cannot get into Syria. Carlotta, how are you getting your information about what is happening inside Syria, given that you cannot go there?
So it's very difficult not to be able to be there, but at the same time, because there are phone lines, phone networks, so people do have a lot of information coming through from, on social media, so we can actually call people. So in that article I just wrote, we did have an extended interview with a mother who was stranded in a village along with two other widows and 14 children. So she explained me a lot of her life at some length, because, she was stuck there and it was in the evening, and so she had time to talk, and she still had electricity. So we get a lot of that. Well, there are people that our reporters have been in touch with from the beginning of the war, so we know them, we know which way they've gone. So we keep in touch in that way with the advancement of the war. I actually just went down to the border and started hanging around there and waiting to talk to people. And so that's how I found the young man who was going back to join up to fight, because his father had died, his family was stranded, homeless, and living, camping out in the open under the trees because they'd had to flee their house. Then you meet the doctors who are going to and fro and tell you the terrible cases they're treating and the urgency of the emergency and so on. You can do it as a writer. You can find your information without actually being there. But, of course, we would prefer to be bearing witness ourselves. And we're trying through the Turkish government to gain access to cross the border.
And can you explain why Russian and Syrian forces resumed their attacks on Idlib?
So it's long been the ambition of the Syrian government to take back control of the whole of the country. And this is the last province which they really have no control over. So it was, and there are opposition fighters who have weapons, and then there's many, many people who fled other areas. There's about 1 million, 1.5 million people who fled from other areas of Syria and went to Idlib because it was still free and they could live there. So you've got a huge strength of opposition people from elsewhere and in Idlib province. And then you've got all the people who always lived in Idlib province, who have lived freely in a system of not controlled by the Syrian government for the best part of 9 years. So it was always the aim of the Syrian government, and since the Russians intervened to support the Syrian government, especially kinetically, militarily in 2015, the push has been to retake all these areas from the opposition forces. And so this was the last one, and we'd been expecting it on and off for years, and so now it came. And they chose to do it in the winter, which is the cruelest, of course, for the opposition and the people, but, militarily probably clever. So it's been a really ruthless advance, and they've stepped it up. They started 18th of December, and it's been really nonstop since, heavy, heavy aerial bombardment and artillery and a very swift movement from the east, pushing people out of their villages and grabbing a lot of territory. So we're now at the stage where we don't know if they're going to try and push the whole way to the border, if they're going to encircle Idlib city, which still has 500,000 people living there, and maybe do a siege. So we're all trying to work out how far they will go. or if President Erdogan of Turkey can actually negotiate some sort of pause or even draw a line where they stop. But it's not at all clear. It looks like Russia and Syrian government want to go the whole way right up to the border.
And in our final minute, Carlotta, what is going to happen to the people who have been internally displaced, some of them many times over?
Well, a lot of them really don't trust the Syrian government. That's the thing. Because they fled other places, which were also, you know, these notorious sieges of Aleppo, of Ghouta, of Dara, people were actually evacuated from those sieges, you know, under incredible horror and hunger. They were evacuated to Idlib. And they were told, including by the Russians, they were told they would be safe there. And so that's a double trauma for them. They thought they were, you know, okay, they had to leave their homes and be evacuated. But they thought, okay, this place is going to be the safe zone. And now it's not. So I think they're going through exceptional trauma. But actually, the terror is where do you stay? Because people are telling us there's no tent, but there's also no space to pitch a tent. Mm. So they're running out of land, and that's where we just don't know what will happen. I mean, some people feel it could be a run on the Turkish border, but I think the Turks are determined not to take more refugees. They've already got 3.5 million refugees. They really don't want more. So actually, you're going to see an unbelievable crisis. That's what everyone, and that's why I used that quote. One of the aid workers I talked to, he said it's the end of the world, because he was describing the scene of the camp with people piling in. And you don't just have people living in their tents, but you have hundreds of thousands of people just standing around because they've got nowhere to go, and they're hoping for some aid. And so you've got hundreds of thousands of people standing right jammed up against the border.
Well, terrifying. Carlotta, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Good to talk to you. Thanks.
Carlotta Gall is an Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times, covering Syria from Turkey. She's been a war reporter for 25 years. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.